Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Hello and welcome to The Sidebar, presented by True Crime Daily, taking you inside the courtrooms of high-profile and notorious cases from across the country. I'm your host, Joshua Ritter. I'm a criminal defense lawyer based in Los Angeles and previously an LA County prosecutor for nearly a decade. You can find me on all social media platforms at Joshua Ritter ESQ or at joshuaritter.com. We are recording this on Friday, March 15th, 2024. In this week's episode, we take a look at the upcoming trial of Chad Daybell and how the proceedings could differ from the prosecution of his wife, doomsday mom, Lori Vallow. But first, the ongoing legal saga of a woman charged with killing her police officer boyfriend as her defense attorney seeks to have the woman's charges dismissed. But before all of that, we have breaking news as James Crumbly, the father of the Oxford school shooter, was found guilty for his part in the killing of four young students. Today, we are very happy to be joined by Matt Johnson, an Emmy award-winning journalist, Court TV correspondent, and host of the podcast True Crime Deadline, spotlighting notorious cold cases. Matt, welcome.
Hey, it's great to be here with you. And I always love talking to you on Court TV. So it's kind of weird being on the other side of the microphone.
I know. Now all the targets pointed at you, we want to hear your thoughts on everything. But I've been looking forward to this too, because I do appreciate when you host on Court TV and when you're doing your reporting, because you have that on the ground insight to a lot of these cases. We talked to many guests who, you know, they've been watching it on TV following it like I have, but you've been in the courthouse for many of the cases we're about to talk about today. So I appreciate you coming on. I've been looking forward to this, and I'm really curious to hear some of your thoughts. So if you're ready, let's jump right in. Out of Pontiac, Michigan, the father of a school shooter has been convicted of involuntary manslaughter charges mere weeks after the child's mother was convicted on the very same charges. James Crumbly faced four counts representing the deaths of Madison Baldwin, Justin Schilling, Tate Meyer, and Hannah St. Juliana, who was shot and killed by Crumbly's son at Oxford High School in November of 2021. Prosecutors alleged that Crumbly was grossly negligent in his parenting, missing opportunities to intervene in his son's actions. While the conviction of his wife, Jennifer Crumbly, also focused on her negligence in parenting, a key distinction in this trial was the father's purchase of the weapon used to perpetrate the shooting. Prosecutors emphasized Crumbly's failure to safeguard the weapon from his son, despite the boy showing clear signs of mental distress. Authorities testified that the pistol was stored in a gun safe with two other firearms, but the father left the safe, get this, with the default entry code of 000. When officers searched the Crumbly home in the wake of the tragedy, the pistol storage case was discovered, with Crumbly, who declined to testify in his trial, faces up to 15 years for the convictions, and his wife is scheduled for sentencing next month. All right, Matt, I'm just going to let you jump in and give us first your thoughts, your reactions to this verdict. Was this surprising to you at all?
I think it's very surprising because it's such a landmark case. And now we're going to have to see if this is going to be a trickle effect across the nation, right? Obviously, you know, our hearts and prayers go out to the four young victims, the lives stolen from this. And I know that their families have spoken to the media and us right after the verdict. And they were, of course, in tears. And I think it's just like letting go that this has been such a long process and letting go what you experience in the courtroom. During the reading of the verdict, when James Crumbly, and we can talk about the differences in his trial versus Wifey, which there's a lot. But, you know, he was shaking his head when he had the headphones on when he was hearing guilty, 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 guilty. And then you had in the gallery right behind him and the prosecutors, these family members that were just breaking down and trying to keep composure because, you know, they respect the court. It's just heartbreaking all the way around. I guess that's my thoughts.
Yeah, that's true. It is heartbreaking all around. And I think it's important we don't lose sight of that this is a tragedy. You know, the four lives were lost. Those families' lives are changed for forever. And now you have this family who's completely torn apart. Both parents now in prison, the child in prison for probably the rest of his life. It really is sad across the board. But I do want to talk a little bit about the differences, because this is one thing that troubled me. And maybe it's a small point, and maybe I'm making more of it. But in the trial of Jennifer, the jurors said afterwards that they concentrated a lot on the fact that she was apparently the last person to have handled that, the last adult, and that gun did not appear to be secured. Well, now in his trial, it's almost the same point is being made, is that gun wasn't locked up properly and that gun wasn't secured and the safe didn't have a code on it. I guess, and tell me if you think I'm overthinking this, but it's almost like they're both being held responsible for not securing that gun safely, when in my view, isn't one person supposed to be the one who last touched it and secured it? Do you follow me on this?
I see what you're saying, and I'm sure that a lot of people were kind of playing that over in their head. But, you know, these are different juries for each of these parents. And both of the parents are culpable, according to the juries that found them independently guilty 1 month from each other. And, you know, we're talking about involuntary manslaughter on all of these counts. So it's going to be a lesser of a sentencing. And they're both going to be sentenced, I believe, on April 16th. So we'll see what statements are made at that point in time. But, you know, in terms of the locking mechanism, not even out of the plastic, they're both responsible for that. They're both guilty of that. They didn't change the code from 0000. They're both responsible for that. I don't care who held the gun last. It's the accessibility to a child that was crying out for help, writing on his math homework, help me, and they're just laughing it off. And, you know, he wants to get back to his Uber rides or Uber Eats, DoorDash, and she wants to get back out drinking and hang out with her horses or whatever they were doing. You know, I just think that you just can't get past that when you're talking about having a role in not securing a weapon with a dangerous person.
Yeah. Well, you're not alone in that thinking. I mean, obviously, two sets of jurors now agree with you that this was, it just stepped over a line and was too much for anyone to accept as responsible behavior. And they held them accountable for their actions or lack of actions in this case. One last point on this, and you kind of alluded to this earlier, but what do you think will be the reaction now? Do you think we'll see more of these cases? Are prosecutors and their offices across the country going to be a little bit more aggressive when it comes to these types of crimes? And I'm not just saying school shootings, but just any crime where you're talking about children or other people being held responsible for the actions of someone else.
So mass school shootings, it's a fact, is a problem of the United States. Yeah. And it's indicative and very, you know, just United States focused. It's not a problem in other parts of the world. But having said that, and, you know, I think that what I expect is if there is more tragedies that we experience, involving schools. I think that parents will be held accountable. It's just a matter of if those laws will be applied in that state. What I hope is that this actually prevents mass shootings and parents actually use this as a learning lesson to maybe look at how their child is acting. Do they need help? Can I intervene? Since, you know, my butt's on the line if I don't help them. And is my weapon in my home necessary? And is it secure away from that person?
Yeah. Well, I think at the bare minimum, it's put parents across the country on notice that if you have a weapon in the house, you better make sure that's stored properly and locked up properly. And if you have a child who's dealing with some mental issues, and this was not mild mental issues, as you pointed out, this was a crisis and he seemed to be screaming for help, that you have to pay more than just lip service to addressing that. So like you said, tragedy across the board. Sentencing will be coming up soon and we will of course follow that and keep everyone updated.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify is got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Let's move to Fremont County, Idaho, where final pretrial motions are underway in the prosecution of a father accused in his first wife's murder and the murder of his second wife's two children as he faces the possibility of the death penalty. Chad Daybell, the fifth husband of doomsday mom Lori Vallow, has pleaded not guilty to the murder of 7-year-old JJ Vallow and 16-year-old Tylee Ryan, along with the murder of his first wife, Tammy. Last year, Lori was convicted on similar charges and faces a life sentence for the counts. Meanwhile, she is awaiting trial in Arizona on additional charges related to the conspiracy to murder her fourth husband and her former nephew-in-law. Incredible. A key distinction in Daybell's trial will be the potential of the death penalty if the man is convicted. Daybell appeared in court last week for a closed hearing concerning potential witnesses and is expected that his trial will be moved to the neighboring Ada County ahead of the April start date, with cameras allowed restricted access to the proceedings. Now, Matt, you were following, I know, Lori's trial very closely. You had been to Idaho, I believe, to inside the courtroom for some of that. Do you think this trial will be, much like the case we just talked about, a kind of replay, run it back, as it were, of the previous trial of Lori Vallo for Chad Daybell's involvement in these murders?
I do think that it's going to be a replay of the same evidence because they're accused in the same crimes, but their actions in the murders is a little bit different. You have different bad facts with him because the bodies were found on his property and the statements that he made. And there, I think we're going to hear more about Tammy Daybell, his wife, who was also murdered according to Lori Vallo's guilty verdict. I think we're going to hear a lot more about that. Now, the big question is whether or not Lori will take the stand or if they're going to point the finger at her, because her defense team, you know, they didn't really bring up Chad as being at fault until the end.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. I smiled when you said that because this is something I have a suspicion of that I don't hear a lot of people talking about, but you're right. There seemed to be this surprising and deliberate effort to not involve Chad Daybell in her trial when Lori was on trial. And you would have thought the natural defense would be, Chad did all of this. I didn't do any of it. He forced me to keep my mouth shut, but I had no idea what he was up to or that he committed these murders.
And that's what our defense team wanted to do. These are good defense attorneys. And, you know, all of you listening at home, I mean, defense is part of our constitution. Like, everyone deserves a defense. They're just doing their job. But, you know, they were very successful in getting the death penalty off the table for her because of discovery issues. That's not the case with Chad Daybell. John Pryor is not currently death certified, which I find interesting, as far as I know, last I checked. But her defense, according to my sources close to her defense, they really wanted to go after the doomsday prophet and say that she kind of got wrapped up in all of this. But she was putting on the brakes and saying, no, I don't want that, which is why if you look at the video from the court cam when they are reading the verdict and everything, it's because she's so upset because she told her attorneys not to talk badly about the prophet, her husband, and they did so anyway in their closings. And during those closings, her arms were crossed, her face was beet red. She was angry at them and did not speak with them.
Incredible. Incredible. So that brings me to my next point here is you mentioned this. I think this is a real possibility. She could, she's an available witness for them to call. Now, she has a Fifth Amendment right to say, I don't want to testify. This could further incriminate me. I've got an appeal pending, whatever. But if she really feels that way, she could definitely be called as a witness in his trial. And if he's willing to throw her under the bus, he doesn't have the same reservations about blaming her, and she's willing to take the rap for him, that is a real possibility, no?
Well, the former hairdresser that was on Wheel of Fortune and tried to be a beauty queen in Texas, she really loves the camera. She asked, leading up to the trial before cameras were not allowed and they only allowed audio for that particular trial, she would ask her attorneys where the camera's positioned and she would look at them. And then she would look for Kay and Larry Woodcock like a psycho and she would smile at them. She smiles on camera. She tries to make makeup behind bars and she loves the attention. So would she take the stand? I think so. I think she's looking forward to her trial in Arizona as well, because we can guarantee that there'll be cameras there, but that's a different case. But in this case, in her husband's case, I think that she would take the stand and not answer any questions or take the fall, because she thinks that she's doing a service for God by being a goddess and following her husband, who's a prophet. If you believe all the craziness.
Absolute madness. I mean, it, again, another tragic case, the loss of children's lives, and now the body count just keeps on adding up. But just putting aside the tragedy of all of it, just madness what this woman has convinced herself of. And you mentioned the cameras. I think that'll be a big change. And certainly if she enjoys being on camera, that could be have a remarkable difference in this case. But one big difference is that I don't know if a decision has been made yet, or maybe you know this, but the death penalty could be on the table here. And if it is, that could have a significant effect on this trial, don't you think?
I think so, Josh, and I don't have the answer if it's just made today or something, but last I checked, you know, it was still on the table, but they haven't made a ruling on that. I mean, we are rapidly approaching to this trial that is just a couple weeks away, right after Easter. And the cameras, it'll be very interesting because, again, that's a difference, right? So the judge didn't allow cameras in the first trial, allowed audio to be released the night after, and then we would air that. Now, in this trial, I think that what we might be able to expect is something very Koberger looking, you know, yeah, where it's the court cameras and it's a little bit at a distance. But I think that you're still going to be able to see enough to get a feel for the trial.
Yeah, yeah. And if they do decide to pursue the death penalty, that'll have a significant effect too on the jury makeup, because the way it works is they have to get what's called a death qualified jury, meaning each one of those jurors who's even potential to sit on the trial has to say that they don't have moral, ethical issues with the death penalty, meaning if they felt it was appropriate, they would vote for it. If they say, I am against it no matter what, they're not qualified to even sit as potential jurors. So that usually means that the jurors you end up with that you're going to pick from skew a little bit more law enforcement, skew a little bit more conservative, and skew a little bit more friendly to the prosecution, which could make things even more difficult for Chad Daybell if they weren't already with the significant convincing amount of evidence we have.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting to find panels that can be qualified around the holiday, which is Easter. So it'll be very interesting. And it'll be interesting, too, to see it play out in the same courthouse, because we think that it's going to be happening there in Ada County instead of Fremont County. But, you know, you have the attorneys that don't want the change of venue. I don't know quite. It's the most reversed ask for a change of venue that you've ever heard, because normally you don't see the prosecutors wanting to change the venue because of publicity in the case from a bigger city to a smaller city. It's just interesting.
Yeah. Well, I guess we're going to be finding out some developments on this soon enough. And I imagine we will be seeing your friendly, smiling face in Idaho when it all starts happening. So we look forward to that, and we will follow you for more updates on it.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Finally, we move to Norfolk County, Massachusetts, where defense attorneys for a woman charged with killing her boyfriend are seeking to dismiss the case and disqualify the district attorney weeks before the trial's start date. Prosecutors claim that Karen Reed hit Boston police officer John O'Keefe with her SUV before leaving the man to die in the snow. However, her defense alleges that Reed is the scapegoat in an elaborate police cover-up and that evidence from a recently unveiled federal probe contradicts the state's theory. In their motion to disqualify, Reed's attorneys asserted that the grand jury indictment was, quote, packed with known lies and other deceptions, including failing to disclose the personal relationship between a state trooper who investigated the case and the family who lived at the scene of the crime. Reed's attorneys also sought to have the Norfolk District Attorney disqualified and sanctioned for allegedly failing to disclose an active federal probe in the case. A judge is currently weighing the defense motions, and Reed's trial is scheduled to start on April 16th, setting aside any further setbacks. All right, Matt, jump in. I know you've been in court for this. I think what is probably one of the most interesting things about this case so far is the spectacle that seems to be surrounding the case and not exactly the details of the case itself. Tell us what it's been like in court.
It is the most unique case that I've ever covered in my career. Like, just think about the facts of the case. So you have this woman, the defendant is accused of killing a police officer. And then you arrive at the courthouse and you see that there are people that look like protesters that are supporters with signs that say free Karen Reed. When she walks into the courthouse, they cheer. And then when she walks into the courtroom, people that are able to sit in the gallery behind the victim, John O'Keefe's family, they're cheering for Karen Reed as well. So just the optics and the division in the small community outside of Boston is just mind-boggling. Nothing else I've ever seen like this.
Was Karen Reed, was she somebody that was known in that area before this, or did all of this kind of celebrity just arise out of this case?
You know, I think that what it is there were an online call to action from certain people that really believed in her facts that she's trying to present through her defense of being framed. And when I talk to people about, why are you out here in 18 degree weather? Why are you out here when it's snowing for these hearings leading up to the trial? They all tell me the same thing, that they believe that she is being framed. And they believe that if it could happen to Karen Reed, then it could happen to anybody. So I think that that's their connection to it, of like, let's take a stand.
Yeah, interesting. Really fascinating. And it's hard. I'm glad that we have you here, because it's, even though it's making national headlines, it's really hard to understand how it's taken over that community, right? I mean, it's become like the thing that people are talking about in coffee shops around that entire area.
And then you drive around in that area. Again, this is about an hour outside of Boston. It's in a bedroom community. Just think, like, if you're in other parts of the country, it looks like a movie set with, you know, steeples and classic, you know, I don't know, colonial homes. And in front of the homes is either support the badge signs or signs that say free Karen Reed, support Karen Reed. It, you know, as if you would see political signs in a neighborhood.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely unlike anything. And I know that I keep saying that, but you talk to people and they say that this has even come between them and friends or them and family members by taking different sides in this case.
Incredible. Wow. Amazing. Well, one thing I want to clear up or explain for listeners, and then I have a last point that I want to ask you about this, but just so that we all are on the same page, what the defense is doing is they're challenging the grand jury indictment here by saying that it was not fair, the evidence that was presented to the grand jury, because it's important to understand a grand jury, convening a grand jury is basically what we call a probable cause determination. It's not the trial. It's just asking the question of the grand jury, is there enough evidence here? Is there probable cause to hold this person to answer for trial? The unique thing about a grand jury, though, is that it's only the prosecution in the room presenting the evidence. So they have to wear two hats, as it were, and present the prosecution evidence, but then they also should be presenting some exculpatory evidence to give the grand jury a fair assessment of the strength of the case. But there's a bunch of case law that says that doesn't mean they have to give every argument the defense may make or every piece of evidence the defense may bring up. And that's what's being attacked here, is the defense is saying they didn't present enough. My personal view is that that's a fairly low standard of proof that should be shown at a probable cause hearing, like a grand jury. I don't think they really have a chance of prevailing on this. And I think that might be indicated by the fact that the judge has kept the trial date set where it's at, which is going to be coming up soon here in April, April 16th. So I think we're heading towards a trial despite all of this argument. But your point on how this is affecting the community, the surrounding idea that this is an elaborate conspiracy, all of this is a bunch of noise, but do you think it's going to have an actual effect on the trial on deciding whether or not her vehicle hit him and she left him to die?
Right. It all comes down to that, right?
Right.
And how each side is presenting. And she has a great defense, by the way. I mean, this is Alan Jackson is the attorney from your neck of the woods that represented a lot of famous people, including Kevin Spacey. So, yeah. I mean, she has this high profile attorney that is making good counterpoints to every point from this indictment that we just learned more about, right? Because it wasn't disclosed to the public as it normally wouldn't be, of all the details that this grand jury made their decision on. 14 days and something like 42 witnesses testified, by the way, and some of the evidence that they heard. So, I mean, it really comes down to whether or not the text message happened at 2 something in the morning, or the text message or the Google search happened, how long to die in the cold, at around 6 something after his body was discovered. And then it also comes down to whether or not her car hit him, and can you prove that? Or is it impossible for someone to die by being hit by her car, or was her car does not show the damage that they say it does? And what's interesting about all of this is, so you have the prosecution saying that they found bits of the taillight at the scene, but they were collected at different times. So that's what the defense is focusing on. Yeah. And so you have the defense saying that those items, those bits of plastic, were planted. And then you have the bombshell that was brought up just a few days ago, where the defense claims that the FBI did an independent test, and their test determined that the taillight couldn't break by hitting a person. So they're using that for their case, and we can expect that in the defense. It's very interesting because the defense has a strong counterpoint for every piece of bad fact, bad evidence in the case.
Yeah. And that's all the defense has to do, right? They don't have to convince everyone of their position. They just have to present enough questions to cause some doubt on the prosecution's positions, right? So prosecution is saying he was hit, he's got fragments on him from the taillight, and that his DNA can be traced to being on her vehicle. And that seems like a fairly straightforward case, but all the defense has to do is start chipping away at that. Well, doesn't this report call that into question? And isn't it bizarre that all of this was collected at different times, and enough confusion, enough questions that go unanswered, and you're starting to build a case where beyond a reasonable doubt is looking like it's more and more difficult. A fascinating case that is bizarre to me, because cases like this take place across the country all the time, and they don't make this kind of news, nor do they cause a community to get turned upside down like this case has. So we will continue to follow that. And I know, Matt, you will be there. We will follow you as you follow it. But in the meantime, that is our show this week. Matt, thank you so much for coming on. Where can people find out more about you?
Oh, True Crime Deadline is my podcast that you mentioned. You didn't have to do that. Thank you. And, because I'm a big fan of yours. And then, of course, I'm on Court TV, bringing you the latest coverage from coast to coast on our trials and true crime stories. But it's been such a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, thank you so much. And I'm your host, Josh Ritter. You can find me on all social media platforms at Joshua Ritter ESQ or at joshuaritter.com. You can find our sidebar episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And we want to hear from you. If you've got questions or comments you'd like us to address, tweet us your questions with the hashtag TCD Sidebar. And thank you for joining us at the True Crime Daily Sidebar.